Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey Jim, great to be back for the latest edition of The Other Hand. I want to start with something today that's not strictly related to economics and finance, although like everything, it eventually will have an impact on economies. Arguably, it already is in places like the United States. And that's the fentanyl epidemic in particular and the war on drugs in general. People like me for a long time have been saying things like the war on drugs was lost sometime in the 1970s, not long after I think it was then President Nixon declared the war on drugs. And you often find people like me, The Economist, and other more learned institutions than I saying that drugs, or at least some of them, should be legalized, and that a bit like alcohol during Prohibition, when you lose a war, you should recognize reality. And there's a fascinating and disturbing article in this week's Economist about the opioid epidemic in general in the United States, and also the particulars around a drug called fentanyl. For those listeners that don't know, it's a mostly synthetic opioid that, for the most part, the drug that is imported into the United States comes from Mexico, often using chemicals, precursors they're called, sourced from China. That's changing a bit, and there are complications in the supply chain of fentanyl, owing mostly to the actions of the authorities. But one basic statistic is that if you need to consume cocaine or marijuana or any relatively bulky drugs, you need long supply chains and lots of deliveries. Fentanyl, which is 50 times more powerful, more potent than heroin, you would need about three lorry loads of it to supply the United States for a year. So it's incredibly potent and very easy to smuggle in the quantities that are needed to supply the demand. And the demand is there. We reckon, or the officials reckon, that there are at least 6 million opioid addicts in the United States. Fentanyl can kill you the first time you take it. Addicts are now taking it alongside injections of an antidote, just in case they overdose. They're taking it with other people present to administer that antidote should it be needed. But an awful lot of people, nevertheless, are dying from it. And the statistics are staggering. The 10-year period for which we have the most recent data reckon that around 1/3 of a million people have died in the United States thanks to opioid overdoses. And the last year for which we have data, something like 75,000 people died as a result of these overdoses. I knew that it was bad, but the reason why I'm citing this story in The Economist is that I didn't realise just how bad it actually is. It's affecting life expectancy statistics in the United States. Now, those stats, of course, are distorted heavily by the recent pandemic, and sorting out what causes what is tricky, but it seems to be contributing to falling overall life expectancy in the United States. That's reversing a trend going back many years where steadily increases in life expectancy were recorded year over year. It is the most dreadful thing. And the Biden administration is spending an awful lot of money on anti-drug stuff. There's the usual crime-related war being waged. And there's also an awful lot of money being spent on education, trying to persuade people not to take this thing. And both the traditional and educational measures seem to be having an effect, but only to the extent that the rate of increase of consumption of these drugs is slowing down. I mean, it's still going up, but the second derivative, if you like, is showing some sign of shallowing. So it's absolutely dreadful. If you look at past drug waves of things like cocaine and other drugs, what happens in the United States eventually washes up on our shores. And yes, fentanyl is here in Europe, but to nowhere near the same extent as the United States. But I was also listening a few weeks ago to a discussion of a New York drugs expert with a BBC radio show. The presenter, Evan Davis, was interviewing her. And he was saying, yes, it isn't on our shores to any great extent at the moment. And her response was very simple. It's not there yet. It's coming your way, as these drugs always do. So I must say that I was appalled, astonished at the numbers. It really is jaw-dropping. And secondly, it made me question my previous stance, which is that drugs should be legalized, because I'm not sure that legalizing fentanyl would be a very, very good idea at all. I'm not quite sure where that leaves me, other than to really repeat the warnings that many people are giving, that this opioid, synthetic opioid thing, is massive in the United States. It's real. It's coming our way. And to, you know, if you're a parent of children, for example, or you know anybody that might be susceptible to this kind of thing, is to warn them in the starkest possible terms. But I must just say, Jim, I don't know what you think, I'm left wondering, A, about my stance on the legalization of drugs, and B, also, what on earth can you do to counter this sort of thing? It's an unfair question for you, because I don't know the answer, but I wonder how these sorts of stats leave you feeling.
Well, the fentanyl thing, I've seen it in San Francisco, for example. It's had a devastating impact on the drug-taking population in that city. And I believe it's the same in many other cities in the United States that I wouldn't visit very often. So it's a huge problem. And I 100% agree with you. It's coming here. Well, it is here, but it is going to come here to a much greater extent. It's incredibly cheap to manufacture. Even if you get a tablet at 50 US cents, you can still make massive profit in manufacturing and distributing illegally. So, you know, I never believed actually that drugs should be legalized, because I just think one drug is a gateway into the next drug, and the people that manufacture these drugs will just continue to move along the curve or the value chain, if you want to call it that, and come up with new, cheaper, more potent drugs that are more dangerous. So I just don't believe that legalizing it would make any difference whatsoever. In fact, I think the fact that it is illegal might just deter some people who may be afraid of the law from actually engaging. Whereas if it's legal, I think, you know, everybody can have a go. And then I think that could rapidly descend into something serious. I've listened to various medical people talk about the psychological and the psychotic impact of even the soft drugs, as we call them, even cannabis, cocaine, and so on. And to me, there's no way you can actually legalize. I think you just have to continue to up the battle against it. The battle will never be won. And as you say, Nixon was the one in the 70s who declared the war on drugs. Look where that has got. But I just think you've authorities have got to try and continue to up the ante to fight it. And I just believe that legalizing will make the whole thing worse.
Okay, Jim. I mean, it's all very bleak stuff. Should we move on to something slightly more cheerful, the latest economic news, which I know there's been a whole rake of.
Yeah, there's been a few things that I think are worthy of comment. The Irish Purchasing Managers Index for services up from 50.5 to 54.4 in February. And in our last podcast, we spoke about the manufacturing index, which was also up quite strongly. So that's indicative of an ongoing healthy level of economic activity in the Irish economy, notwithstanding the technical recession based on GDP that we spoke about last week. But all economic indicators really continue to suggest that Ireland is doing reasonably well. In contrast, we continue to see pretty weak data out of parts of the euro area. French industrial production this morning down by 1.1%, much weaker than expected in January. So that's another indication of the pressure that's building on the European Central Bank to move on the interest rate front. That's really as much as there is on the economic data front at the moment. It's quite enough. The next one I'm waiting to analyse will be the publication of the end February Exchequer returns here, which I think will be due out Tuesday evening, as far as I know. Another story that caught my attention over the weekend involved Sinn Féin again. There was a story in some of the Sunday newspapers suggesting that the Department of Finance and the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform have taken issue with the funding of the 6.8 billion budget alternative budget package that Sinn Féin presented last October at budget time. And they were saying that there's a wide divergence between Sinn Féin's financial estimates of the costs and public officials. So this is, I think, the beginning of more scrutiny being paid to the sorts of promises that Sinn Féin is making, because as we've often discussed, the Sinn Féin rhetoric is basically they'll spend money on everything and they'll solve every problem. But we need to ensure that the basis for which these claims are being made are actually correct from a financial perspective. The opinion polls continue to be interesting. The latest opinion poll at the weekend from the Sunday Independent and Red Sea showed Sinn Féin down 2 points at 27%. Fine Gael up 1 at 20, Fianna Fáil up 1 at 18. The Social Democrats are doing well, up 2 points to 7%. Labour unchanged at 4, the Greens up 1 at 4%. So this is a reversal of the improvement we've seen in the previous opinion poll from the Sunday Business Post in relation to Sinn Féin. But it certainly does suggest, you know, that the main parties are basically stagnating. You know, they're not making much progress, and goes back to a conversation we had last week that how you form a government out of all of this is going to be incredibly difficult, and government formation could take some time, as we discussed.
Yeah, don't know what to say in response to all that, other than perhaps to add one small bit of an answer to a question that you asked me on the last podcast, which was when I was meeting with a whole bunch of Irish people in London recently, what did they think of Ireland? And I gave all sorts of answers to that question. But the one thing that I omitted was that they were all nervous to a greater or lesser extent. It wasn't the same reaction from everybody, but they were all nervous about what a Sinn Féin government means for business. And I know that there has been, I think it's probably putting it a bit strongly to say that there's been a Sinn Féin-led charm offensive to try and persuade people that they wouldn't be terrible for business. But I'm not sure I've met many people who actually believe that yet. That's in contrast, of course, to here in the UK, Labour have been trying for a long, long time to assuage fears that they wouldn't be good for business. And I think they've had an easier and more successful task than Sinn Féin. I think Labour have persuaded a lot of people with their very strict economic policies that they wouldn't damage the economy at worst, and at best might even be good for the economy, better than the current lot. Sinn Féin have not managed that. And I do think business people, the ones that I've been speaking to recently, as I say, it varies, but they're all, to an extent, nervous about what Sinn Féin means for the economy. I think you'd probably share that, wouldn't you, Jim?
I certainly would, yeah. But I've said many times that one of the really interesting political developments here over the coming months will be the evolution of Sinn Féin's economic policy platform ahead of local and European elections in June, and a general election which has to be held in the next 12 months at this stage. So I'll be watching that closely, as I think will everybody else, and as should everybody else. Politics, obviously really intriguing at the moment. I noticed in France at the weekend that Marine Le Pen launched the European election campaign for her party. And she vowed to wrest back powers from the intrusive and authoritarian bureaucracy in Brussels. And she was pushing her 28-year-old protege, Jordan Bardella, who heads her RN party and who's going to, he'll be top of the ticket for the June election. And this election in France is going to be incredibly important because Le Pen is trying to replace Macron when he steps down in 2027. And in the context of these European elections generally, clearly the thing to watch will be the performance of the right. And as I've spoken about before, the expectation is that for the first time in the history of the European Parliament, the right will hold the balance of power within the Parliament, whatever that means. But certainly what it does mean is that these parties, while they don't have a common agenda, they differ widely from country to country. The one thing they do seem to have in common is a deep antipathy towards the European Union. So that's going to be another awkward challenge for the European Union going forward, I think. But it's interesting. Anyway, I think, you know, the performance of Le Pen in France will really, really be worth watching over the next 3 years. In the context of US politics, it's a big week. Today, we're recording this on Tuesday morning. It's Super Tuesday. 15 states will be voting for the person who will represent the Republican Party in the presidential election in first Thursday in November. And just to put Super Tuesday in context, 874 delegates are up for grabs in the various 50 in the 15 states today, and 1,215 delegates will be needed to win that particular race. Nikki Haley won in Washington, D.C. On Sunday, 62.9 to 33.2 for Donald Trump, and she's become the first woman in history to win a Republican primary, and it's probably the last primary she's going to win in this particular campaign because, you know, at the end of Super Tuesday, the likelihood is that Trump will be virtually the anointed one because Haley's victory in Washington, D.C. just gave her 19 delegates. So you can see the insurmountable problem in preventing Donald Trump from actually making the starting line in November. And of course, we saw the Supreme Court decision in Colorado saying that Trump cannot be prevented from being on the ballot there. So certainly things are building in Trump's favor at the moment. I heard a discussion and speculation that actually if Nikki Haley ran as a third party, you know, non-aligned candidate in the presidential election, that she could do serious damage to Donald Trump. It's speculation. Chances are it won't happen, but it would appear to be reasonably straightforward for Donald Trump now getting from here to November 5th.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And then on to the White House, because also over the weekend, a New York Times poll was released which showed clear daylight now opening up between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Donald Trump had a 5-point lead in this particular poll, which is the biggest he's had for quite some time, I think, and would be enough, most people seem to think, to get him into the White House if that poll is replicated in November. So not a good day for Biden supporters, who were asked, as part of that poll, sophologists have dug into it to ask why people are not saying they're going to vote for Biden. Why is he so unpopular? And it was a very simple answer. He's too old. And that does seem right or wrong. It's the feeling that people have. And I think it does raise the possibility again, or the question at least, that will somebody tap Biden on the shoulder and say, come on, Joe, it's time to step aside. It is said that the only person that could do that with authority and achieve that outcome would be his wife. I don't know, obviously, that's a deeply personal matter for the Bidens. But the Democratic Party itself clearly seems unable to recognize the problem it faces and is unable to do anything about it, and doesn't have the power or the authority or even the willingness, it seems, to ask Biden to step down. In some senses, it's too late. There's all sorts of talk about the possibility that when the Democrats assemble all their delegates, that it could be a contested convention and all these peculiarities of the American way of doing things. But it does look very bleak for the Democratic Party, for Joe Biden at the moment. It's a long way to go, as you were undoubtedly about to remind me. There's a long way to go between now and November, 8 months to the election. But right now, if it was held today, it would be extremely problematic for Biden. And I think we'd be looking at the second term of office for Donald Trump.
Yeah, the one thing that's really starting to dominate US political discourse at the moment is just building is the migration issue. I listened to a podcast at the weekend from The Economist, actually, about New York City and the huge problem New York has at the moment with accommodating migrants coming into the city. And that there is a legal right to shelter in the New York Constitution. So it's creating massive political problems. But all over the states, the migration issue is becoming more and more toxic. And the stories from the southern border at the moment, it's not alone Mexicans and Central American people coming into the United States at this stage. It's now sort of suggested that there's a lot of Chinese and other nationalities starting to use that southern border to come through. So apparently it's utter chaos down there. And a lot of cities across the United States are really struggling to deal with this. New York, I mentioned, Denver is another one. San Francisco is another one. And whether this is cause and effect, I'm not sure. But one thing I think all of those cities have in common is they're all controlled by the Democrats. And that is also feeding into, I think, the growing unpopularity of Joe Biden, because, you know, the Democratic Party under Biden certainly is not seen by many people as addressing this migration problem in any significant way. So it's a toxic mix. There is no doubt about it. And it is a toxic mix like this, and the sort of policy vacuum it creates, that enables somebody like Donald Trump to get onto the podium.
Yeah, migration, I think, is a bit like one of those housing, like the housing issue that we talked about last time and several times in the past. The it's a real problem. There's no denying its reality. And even those of us that have a relatively relaxed view about immigration, a bit like my discussion of the numbers around drugs, I'm astonished by the numbers that of people that are coming in through the southern border. There's been an exponential increase in recent times, and it's chaos down there. There's no doubt about that, as you say. And the numbers speak for themselves. They're off the charts. And as I say, even people like me that are relaxed about it go, whoa, can you have too much of a good thing? Because, as you know, I do think immigration in and of itself is usually a good thing. But when you have so much of it so quickly, and the pressures that therefore that puts on things like not least accommodation, but a whole host of other things, you think, well, I mean, something needs to be done about this. But we don't have a southern border problem in the United Kingdom. We don't have a southern border problem in Ireland, but we do have immigration problems. And like housing, I notice it's a global problem in some ways. Countries that are poor, countries that are the victims of climate change, countries that have, let's call it what it is, shit life syndrome, and the populations are on the move in a big way, and they want to come where life isn't quite so awful, and indeed life is quite good. And what you can actually do about that, I don't really know, because so many governments are struggling with this and are not coming up with solutions. We, you know, in the UK, you've got the ridiculous Rishi Sunak talking about the small boats problem. That's not the problem when it comes to immigration. It's a much bigger issue than that. And nobody here seems to be able to come up with solutions. Nobody's coming up with solutions in the United States. And of course, you've got your own issues in Ireland. So it's one of those intractable problems, Jim. I'm just not sure there are any easy solutions.
No, isn't it ironic, though, Chris, that the United States is a country that's demonized by many people around the world? Okay, it's everybody's favorite enemy, pretty much. And I certainly wouldn't count myself. I love going to the United States. It's my favorite place to visit, you know, and I go as often as I can. But yet, it is demonized by many places, you know, the Chinese, the Islamic world obviously has huge issues with the United States. Yes, it is the country that they all want to go to. If it's that bad, what the hell is going on? And then you look at the United Kingdom, and I know we have slightly different views on the UK, but also, you know, the UK is variously described as a bit of a hellhole at this juncture. But it's still a country that a lot of migrants want to come into. So if it's that goddamn bad, what is happening? So I just think the whole thing is fascinating. And in fact, in relation to the UK, I guess we should mark the point that the latest opinion poll shows the Labour Party at 47% and the Tories at 20%. And in the first past the post election system that the UK has, that would obviously deliver a massive majority for the Labour Party. So as if it wasn't nailed on already, but certainly the likelihood of Keir Starmer being the next Prime Minister is just becoming more and more real and more imminent. And it will be absolutely fascinating, I think, to see after a number of years of Tory government with various leaders like Liz Truss and Boris Johnson, of course, what life is going to be like under a Labour government. Are we going to get the sort of revolution we got with New Labour and Tony Blair and Gordon Brown back in 1997? Or is it just going to be more of the same? And given Starmer's personality, it's hard to see him being revolutionary, isn't it?
Oh, agreed, Jim. I mean, he may well have kept it hidden, but his revolutionary tendencies are notable for their absence. And indeed, policy initiatives generally are notable by their absence. If he does what he says he's going to do, which frankly isn't very much, and then it is more of the same. The kind of things that you need to turn the UK economy around are absent from Labour's manifesto. That doesn't mean, of course, that they won't go off and do and try to do lots of different things. But on the basis of let's listen to what they're saying and believe them, it's going to be same old, same old. There's not going to be much change. They're going to be very fiscally prudent. They're not going to spend much money. And one of the things the British economy needs is spending. I could talk all day about the UK budget today, which has been a farcical process as Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, flails around looking for tax cuts that he can't afford, and the ludicrous fiscal arithmetic around all of that. There's one salient point about this, which is that they have this target for national debt as a proportion of the economy that they've essentially inherited from George Osborne, that also brilliant not Chancellor of the Exchequer. And it's a ludicrous target that produces stupid policies and really numbers that make no sense whatsoever. And there is no, the particular point that I would make is that there's no credence, no acknowledgement of the fact that there are different types of spending and that investment spending is a good thing. And there's actually nothing wrong with borrowing to invest, provided you get a decent return on your investment. Borrowing for investment within prudent limits is a very reasonable thing to do. And these rules that they've inherited from George Osborne, which are stupid, prevent them from doing that. And a very simple initiative that Keir Starmer could have taken already would be to say that we are going to borrow to invest, but he won't do it because he's scared of, I don't know what he's scared of, shadows, George Osborne. Anyway, both the Tories and the Labour say they won't borrow to invest, which is something that they should do. And until somebody says we are going to invest in the UK economy, and it has to start in the public sector, because one of the things that both low and volatile, extremely volatile public sector capital spending has done, it's contributed to very low private sector capital spending. So the UK is an economy that doesn't invest in itself. And until somebody produces a big change to make sure that somebody, either in the public and or private sector, preferably both, invests in the UK is going to be same old, same old. And you and I are going to be having these discussions forever.
Okay, Chris, I know we're up against the clock here. Just one final point I think that's worth referencing this today and this week indeed. This year is the 75th anniversary of the People's Republic of China, and the National People's Congress is on this week. And Li Qiang, the premier, in a long and broad-ranging speech overnight, was talking about a growth target for GDP of 5%. In 2024, which will be challenging and will require a lot of stimulus. He's talking about an inflation rate of 3%. That's up from 0.2% in 23, and an urban unemployment rate of 5.5%. So basically what we're getting out of China this week is a pretty upbeat assessment of what the Chinese authorities intend doing in terms of injecting stimulus into the world's second largest economy. It's significant. Let's see how it materializes. The other point is that he announced a 7.2% increase in defense spending. So here we have ramping up of that whole geopolitical issue around China. So Chris, we'll wrap it there. My parting comment is that, did you know in this day in 1953, Joe Stalin died?
I did not know that, Jim, but yeah. I would say rest in peace usually when I hear those sorts of things, but I'm a bit reluctant.
Chris, good to talk.
Cheers, buddy.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. market.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.